we got rid of all the zippy sayings and
testing.
I can barely hear you.
I'm Shamizan from Hudson. You are listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM. Thank you.
Give me 1 second. I can barely hear you.
Host of Final Where? WGXC. When? Every first of
the
12:10 to 2 p.m. What? Streaming online at WGXC.org. What? Tune in for a genre shakedown, all kinds of choice cuts of wax for you and yours to listen to. Dig it.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by the Country Shepherd, a construction consultation and client representation service for custom residential projects and maintenance. The Country Shepherd advises clients on every element of their renovation, ground up build or remodel, from hiring the right craftsmen to managing timelines to locating the exact materials that their clients require. Founder Jeff Wilcox has been building custom residences since 1990 in New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, California, and Italy. For more information, visit thecountryshepherd.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Molly in Baltimore, Maryland. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Right now? Welcome. This is Race Talks with your host, Kimberly Y. Irwin. This is a special, very special time of the month because this is the week of Juneteenth. It's also the week that just passed where we celebrated Fathers during Father's Day. So with Race Talks, where we have the very necessary conversation on race and ethnicity, we will be talking about these two important events that have happened, well, and will happen. Also, we are recognizing this month as Men's Mental Awareness Month. And we also have a special guest. Usually we'll have one or two guests, but this time we have three and a very special guest that will top off our segment. I wanted to make sure everyone's aware to get ready to be near a telephone because we have an amazing ability this time. I say amazing because I actually never have been on air with this as a possibility. One can call in. So we're going to be giving you a call-in time. Of course, my favorite fan has become my production assistant, and Mr. Garrett Roche of the Roche Solid Truth podcast will be here to give you that information. So get ready to write down the phone numbers. So right at the before we end, we'll ask for you to call in and share with us your story or ask us a question or one of my guests a question about what we talked about and what's transpired. So because we have a jam-packed show, I'm going to get us started. And because we have in our actual studio in Catskill a very wonderful person whose support for me, even before I actually was on the radio, was so wonderful that I welcomed him to my show that is actually exploring the identities of fathers with our theme, Each One, Reach One, Fathers for Life. And this particular gentleman, I'm going to say his name is Johannes Froebel Parker, but some people like to call him John. But I like to say Johannes. So he's going to come on and share what his passion is and what he's made many of us who know him interested in. Well, I'm going to just ask you to take it away. But before you do, tell us about your passion. Please share a little bit about who you are, your identity.
Kimberly, thank you so much. As you know, I'm a retired teacher, but my real passion is genealogy and also genetics and where we come from, what our makeup is, what we think we are, and what our genome tells us that we are. And it's interesting that we're talking about all of these issues, because I had as you can see, your listeners cannot see, but I am very light hair, complected. But recently I received from my genome analysis, it said, Mr. Parker, you should have blonde hair and you should be very dark complected. And yet I'm not. And so I said, I don't know where that came from in my genome. Last night I found out my father's genome that I inherited from him, the number one ethnicity on his chromosome, is Egyptian. I had no idea.
Whoa!
Where Egyptian. It came from, we'll have to find out. So those are the things that come out when we study our genomes and our genotypes, as opposed to our phenotypes, which is the way we appear. But our genotype is much more complex. So that's sort of what I find passion in, and leads me to write books.
So you've written how many books exactly?
Oh, I think 8.
Can you tell me one of your favorite or most successful title?
Well, if we talk about success as far as commercial success, I would say they're all about the same, because I'm not making millions of dollars or anything. But the one that really satisfies me is about Grand Duchess Anastasia Nikolaevna Romanov, whose 123rd birthday is today. And Garrett and Victoria Signorelli and I have just returned from a trip to the monastery, Russian Orthodox Monastery in Herkimer County, where a lady is buried under the name of Evgenia Smetisko. But my research says that she really was Anastasia herself. And even though Evgenia came to America saying that she was born in 1899, the monastery has her buried with the birth date of 18 June 1901, which is exactly the birth date of Grand Duchess Anastasia Romanov. So this is fun to be able to say to the church and other historians, I think you got this wrong. We really need to review this because something is not adding up. And so that's a lot of fun, and it's a challenge.
Well, some people would say that kind of in-depth research is not fun. It's extraordinarily tiresome and cumbersome, but what makes you feel like it's relevant and necessary?
I almost feel that it's a divine task, because I believe it and the world does not believe it, but yet I'm not influenced by what the world is telling me. I'm driven by what I believe inherently is the truth. And so we shall see what comes out of all of this research. I did find out something very interestingly about Anastasia Romanov, who basically was Danish and German and Russian, that she did have ancestry in Africa also, through a man named Ibrahim Pavlovich Ganibal. And this is a very interesting story, which is not in my book, but I found out doing some research this last week that Anastasia, through her great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, who then was also the granddaughter of Queen Charlotte von Mecklenburg-Strelitz, who was then the granddaughter of Ibrahim Pavlovich Ganibal, that she has this this inheritance from Africa. He was kidnapped as a child and given to Catherine the Great and raised at court as a trophy because he was a child of an Ethiopian prince. He was then raised in the Russian court. He was ennobled, became very, very wealthy, is rumored to have had some affairs with noble women. So his line carried down through these various lines into the nobility of Europe. And he ended up being a landowner with serfs himself, with Russian serfs. So I think it's very interesting backstory to the story of Anastasia Romanov, who everybody believes, no, not everybody, we don't believe it, that she was murdered in 1918 by Bolshevik forces in Yekaterinburg, Russia. But I believe firmly, and as my guests here do today also, that this idea of playing a role that she was dead was really her technique to keep her life. So she assumed a pseudonym to be able to live a life somewhat relatively free of fear of being killed by Bolshevik forces.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was asked, how would you tie this theme of each one reach one, fathers for life, with Romanov
history? Well, there you go, because now we know that one of Anastasia Romanov's grandfathers probably is not who is shown on her birth records and baptismal records, but was somebody with a very interesting, compelling story. Any of your viewers or listeners who watch Bridgerton on Netflix?
Well, I do.
Do you really? Well, then you know about it. Queen Charlotte. Right? Queen Charlotte?
Yes.
This is Charlotte von Mecklenburg-Strelitz,
right,
who was then a granddaughter of Ganibal.
Okay.
And that turns out to be a relative of Anastasia. So we're finding Anastasia's deep ancestry.
And that's the thing. Ancestry goes long on both the father and the mother's tree. Of course, we use our father's last names in many cultures, so that name and that legacy is on for a much longer time period. But this is changing in many places. Mm-hmm. I actually have my mother's maiden name, Irwin. And I should say maiden name because she's never gotten married. She was never married, so she stayed maiden. And there was a time when you could not admit something like that on air or to your neighbor, right? I'm only in small communities, and it was hush-hush. And that's one of the reasons I usually, when I start my show, give a specific speech to let people know that my show is about race and ethnicity, but there's really one race, the human race, and many ethnicities. And when we say race or racial, it means the human race and many different racial identities within the human race, which are ethnicities. And slowly, I think that's coming to pass, too. So everything changes, right? And some things stay the same, but many things change. And certainly how we look at fathers and their role in one's life is a constant changing pattern because of how we end up socially engaging with each other, right?
Absolutely.
So I'm thankful that you're here and that you would stay on, right, so that you can be part of our roundtable.
Because I would love to. Thank you very much.
Garrett is going to share after this next segment what the phone number is going to be. And then we'll have another guest on. And then we'll have our roundtable. So thank you for staying here.
Thank you so much.
And your guest, too. Did you mention your guest's name?
I did.
Okay, great. See, I wasn't paying attention at all.
and talking about relatives, you realize we took the gene test. We never knew each other before. We're all related. We're all DNA relatives.
Wow, DNA relatives. Well, technically, we are all DNA relatives.
Yeah.
Right?
But we can really see
you're
it.
You're more recent.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm looking at this very handsome gentleman. I'm just going to say that. We have a guest on, not unfortunately in our studio, but he is on Zoom. His name is Ray Warren, and I have the pleasure of sharing a few things about Mr. Warren that I just came across recently. So I'm just going to say, Ray, I understand you were a former professional athlete and you were interested in healing. And what you found through healing was scuba diving. And I believe that that was one of the reasons why I sought you out, because I don't really know too many people who scuba dive. And then I don't think of scuba diving as healing. Maybe it's cathartic because you're in water, but healing. Right. So I'm really interested in you're talking a little bit about that, because we are looking at men's mental health month, mental health awareness month. And my uncle, I had two uncles who had mental illness from the time that they were in their mid-20s to their death. And they lived to be in mid-70s. And one of my uncles they're both former athletes, high school athletes that were well-known and winning championships, going on to colleges. And my uncle, America's Moses Cash III, who actually wrote a book, a book of poetry. He was very creative, but his mind kind of, one would say he lost his mind. Is that what we say when they went mental or something like that? I don't know if I'm sure that's not the right terminology. But at the time, in the late 70s, early 80s, people didn't talk about mental health, and they certainly didn't talk about Black men needing needing health in their, within their mind and understanding. And with him being chosen as a 76er, he was drafted by the 76ers, he just had a future that looked like it was golden, and then it wasn't. And so, he was a sports person, and he probably was in desperate need of some space to go to find healing mentally. So I'm going to let you share more about yourself and then share a little bit about, why being on Race Talks is a, really great avenue for sharing who you are and what you're about.
Thank you for giving me the forum, the platform. So a little bit about me. I grew up in the Bay Area. So I'm originally from Richmond, California, where I don't know if too many people are familiar about that place, but it's very dangerous. The Bay Area in general is just a very rough place to grow up, especially as a young Black man. It's kind of like we were born on a battlefield. So I would always tell people, I never knew how to live. I was taught to survive. So wasn't really too many ways out coming from where I'm from, besides selling drugs or sports, or you're an entertainer. That was pretty much all our options. As a kid, though, I always had an interest in the water. My biggest thing, because I was always the smallest until I grew up and grew bigger than everyone.
I was going to say, I don't see that small, because I saw your picture. You looked awfully tall. How tall are you exactly now?
I'm 6'3".
Okay.
So until I grew up and got to be bigger than everybody, I was like the run of the family. So my cousins would always dunk me underwater, and I would just hold my breath for as long as I can. And for me, I just always felt safe, or always felt at peace, or just calm. So in order for me to beat my cousins, I would always challenge them to, let's see who can hold their breath the longest. So that's really that's where my passion came from, as far as water goes.
Trying to stay alive.
trying to stay alive. So after my last injury, I ruptured my Achilles a week before I was supposed to go to camp with the Bengals. And I at that point, I didn't feel like I had anything else to live for. And I was in a place where I had never, experienced or been familiar of. Like I said, I grew up in a rough neighborhood, but I never dealt with anything quite like this. So I didn't know what it was. And then I would hear people talking about depression and anxiety and all these other things, but these were all foreign things to me, because this isn't something that's really talked about in the Black community. So for me, it was, what do I do next? I didn't have anything else to fall back on. I didn't have a skill, a craft, a trade. I didn't know how to do anything but, you know, play football. And so I had a cousin who, she did a Peace Corps in Tonga, and she was scuba diving. And I saw her next to a gray whale, and she was like, hey, you got to try this. And I just remember I was in a very dark place. I was actually on suicide watch.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I drove past this place, and it said, try scuba for free. And I went to go try it and just absolutely fell in love with it. I was like, I can be fully submerged underwater for almost an hour, you know.
Memories, fond memories.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, it was scuba diving. Actually, I like to tell a lot of people it saved my life. And after it did that, I wanted to become an instructor to be able to teach this to the minority communities. Also, I created a nonprofit a little bit after I got hurt. I created a nonprofit just because I didn't want kids to put all their eggs into one basket. So my nonprofit was originally tailored for the student athlete because that was my path. And through my nonprofit, we just, you know, tried to give, you know, basic life skills, tried to educate kids on the real economics and not the economics that they teach you in school.
Mm-hmm.
Teach kids about credit. You know, in the Black community, credit is, you don't really get taught about that. I didn't pretty much learn credit until 2021.
And credit is king. And it's best to start when you're young you can get that credit score high. Yes.
And that's and so being a minority business owner, these are the kind of problems that you run into because you don't have these tools and these outlets to let you know that, hey, you have to have your credit for so long in order to apply for these loans and all these other things. So being a minority business owner, the key I found that was a problem was not having enough credit history in order to help you get the funding that you need to, you know, follow your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So after learning that, this was something I really wanted to educate to the minority community. And when I say minority, I don't just, you know, talk about Black specific. I help everyone. I'm not, you know, I don't discriminate against any race, color, gender, none of that.
Any one race, Ray?
Yeah. I never, yeah, no.
I'm trying to school people here. You got to fall in line. There are some places where you're still checking boxes that they mention race, but many of them are saying ethnicity now.
And the box checking gets a little confusing now to me, so I try to have someone else do it for me so I don't mess up.
Well, before I forget, because you told a story that's intriguing, but as I was listening to you, I'm like, he's being very, he's not sharing the entirety of who he is and what he does. Like you said, you started an organization, but you didn't mention the name.
One Step Away Foundation. Yeah, sorry about that.
No, that's my job. To make sure.
Sometimes I don't like too much talking about me and what
I know, but that's my job.
I love to help people. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. But so One Step Away Foundation is the name of my nonprofit. And right now, like I said, originally it was tailored towards the student athlete, but a lot of parents would give me like backlash and saying that, you know, hey, is that all you know how to do is sports? Can you work with the kids that really need help? And it's like, no matter what you do in life, you're always going to get some type of negative feedback. But I took it as positive reinforcement, right? So I was like, you know what? You're right. How can I help the kids that grew up how I grew up? Like I said, I grew up in a very rough neighborhood. Right down the street from my house was a foster home. And for some reason, all the foster kids would be at my house. And they loved my uncle. My uncle was like just... He's a funny guy. He just treats people with love and respect. And so all the foster kids would be at our house. He would cut their hairs, no charge. And so this was like a model that I wanted to kind of take and build my own legacy with. You know, my family, we would always go feed the homeless for Christmas. And I never really understood what that meant and the impact that it could have until I got older. So just these are the type of teachings and everything I want to instill in the people that I work with, just to try to, you know, shine a little light in this world, this dark that we live in today. So that's pretty much how my nonprofit got started. Going back to me scuba diving, once I fell in love with it so much, I was like, I want to become an instructor. I got to teach and educate the youth about the underwater career. So underwater careers are starting off at six figures, but a lot of people don't know this industry. So you don't know what you don't know, right? And so I took it upon myself to try to learn, do, teach, to educate, you know, hey, we can get, there's other ways to make money versus going to go be an athlete or going to go be an entertainer or, you know, being selling drugs or whatever, however you make your money. There's more avenues and there's more ways. And so I ended up opening up a scuba shop. And through my scuba shop, I was just basically trying to teach the diversity or bring the diversity to the scuba industry, where the minority community makes up of 8% of the diving industry. So this was just something that I was trying to shape and mold. And
well, that's a lot more than I
thought. I've been doing
a
good job so far.
I think so. I think that's a lot more than I was aware of. I was thinking it would probably be 2%. So 8% seems like an extraordinarily large number. But I just want to say you helped a segue into the next segment. You mentioned father. You mentioned your uncle.
Yes.
So you need a role model.
Yes.
And I believe that those young people who didn't have families, they found your home a pleasant place to be, a safe space. So that's something else that, you know, what fatherhood does, or, you know, having a father or a father-like figure around. And then you mentioned care, self-care. He would cut their hair, right? Doing something like that. I mean, I can just remember my mother washing, you know, simple things like washing someone's hair or instructing them on how to care for themselves. I mean, I still have my mother's, you know, words in my ear. And I keep saying my mother because some mothers out there, I know you're listening, our fathers too, right? And yes. So not obviously in the male image, but doing the work that men tend to do as fathers, you know, doing the support, the safety, the care. I can just run stories about, you know, how my mom did that. So we're going to, I wanted to know if you were finished, because we're going to come back to you and
okay.
Make sure you have the ability to bring together how scuba diving, I mean, or, you know, scuba diving and your foundation has now come together and build bridges and okay. Foster entrepreneurship, right? So
yes.
Keep that in mind. And okay. We're going to segue, well, I think we've already segue into what makes a good father figure. I see my next guest is, he was driving, but my next guest is someone, if you are paying attention to my show, you already know, Mr. Eric Thompson. I can read a few things about him, but why? Since he can share so much more enlightenment about who he is and what he does. I will say that before we do that, I wanted to introduce like I said, my production assistant, who is ready to go to get you knowledge on how to phone in so that you can engage with our guests during right after the next segment. So, Garrett, take it away.
Thank you, Kimberly. If listeners would like to add some nuts and bolts to this bridge of positivity, which is the goal of WGXC here, please call in 518-622-2598 and select option 3 for call in on the studio line when you hear the automated prompted voice of our very own Philip Grant from WGXC. Please, let's go for it.
All right. And I like that you mentioned the phone number, because I'm just now looking at your bio, Eric, Mr. Thompson, and you are the outreach supervisor at 518-SNUG. That's an acronym, S-N-U-G, and I'm going to let Eric tell you what it's about and how it came about. But how I got to know Eric was through an opportunity to network with other business owners and people who are leaders in their community. And what we haven't usually talked about on our past segments, Eric, is that you are a dedicated father. And since we're highlighting fathers, I definitely want you to take a moment to express how, you know, what we have said about fathers and what more you can add to what role of fatherhood is and the importance. And then, of course, you are an urban youth specialist. And what does that mean? And do we still use the term urban to discuss our minority or African-American population? Are times changing so that we can bridge the gap? Kind of like what Ray said, that he started out, you know, looking at minority young students who were like him, and then branched out and decided that if you needed help and you came to him, he was going to be that provider for you. So without further ado, Mr. Eric Thompson, my friend, thank you for being on Race Talks. Please share. Just do you.
Well, good afternoon or good evening, everybody. I do appreciate the information that's been shared. That was a great program that you have with scuba diving, because that kind of is a segue into what we do. We work in Albany to reduce violence by mediating conflicts with the highest risk individuals of doing a shooting or being shot. So to expose kids and people in general to things outside of their daily lives, outside of their normal surroundings, to give them aspirations beyond their doorstep, beyond the corner, or whatever area that they may be environmentally, is very important to anchor them to a future that is beyond where they're at the moment.
Recording in progress.
In terms of fatherhood, I'm actually working with an organization right now called Men on a Mission, and we have a poem that I had put forth called "How Did the Mighty Lion Lose His Roar?" I'll send it to you. And that's what fatherhood is really all about. It's about being able to exude understanding. See, we think roar means, you know, to yell. Really, it's a warning call. It's an affirmation of power and trust. And these are the things that too often our youth don't feel from us adults. You know, we often say kids don't listen to us. Kids don't listen. Kids don't listen. But how often do we listen to them? The brother said, we're born on the battlefield. And this is very true. People fail to realize that many of our youth are born in urban war zones. They're no less traumatized than many kids in Ukraine or Gaza. Mm. They deal with gunshots on a daily basis. They deal with a desensitization of the elements in their life. They deal with a marginalization that creates voids within their ability to, quote unquote, maybe use certain moral structures that we would think are better for them, or to find healthy outlets. All of these things get skewed when, like the brother said, you're not thinking about the future when you're trying to make it through the night. You're not thinking about the future when you're trying to make it through the day. When you're going to school and you go to sleep and the whole, if the faculty is yelling at this kid because they're sleeping in the class, but failing to realize this may be the same kid that's being abused at night at home. This may be the only place where this kid feels safe to sleep. So my mission through 518 Snug, Snug is Gun Spelled Backwards, beyond reversing the senseless tide of gun violence, is to introduce concepts to our adults that we stop blaming children.
Okay.
That's one of the biggest flaws of our new generation. We say the kids are so different, kids these days, but the parents these days, yes, that find solace in pointing the finger at a child and saying, you're the problem. Something's wrong with you. Nothing's wrong with us adults who are creating these situations, who are building these mechanisms for them to have this self-destruction. There's more guns in America than people. No kids pressing up the guns. Social media, there's no kids creating these things. So I have a real big bone to pick with any parent, any adult that points a finger at a 13-year-old, a 12-year-old.
Or a 15-year-old just recently, even. A 15-year-old.
Excuse me?
A 15-year-old just did some violence to a family member.
Oh,
and she wasn't listened to, you know, and that's the thing. She told, when someone tells you what they're going to do, right? And then when they did, when you allow it to happen, they told you they were going to do it. You didn't, you know, that's like a call for help, right? And that's what you're finding, that 100%. Children know when they are in need, but they just don't really know exactly the right way, and I'm doing quote unquote with my fingers, because the right way is just to say, this is what I'm going to do. So they're saying, please help me, stop me. Right. But right. We're not listening. You're right. I was a certified teacher, and we don't get as much training in social maneuvers with young people. I mean, some people were saying, are you book smart or street smart? And I say, you need to be both.
Indeed.
You don't have to come from the streets to know about the mechanisms that create the violence in the streets, and how to support students who are coming from those backgrounds to make them, I mean, just do their hair, right? You know, like with Ray saying, you know, just creating the environment so that they can be successful.
Well, I agree totally. I mean, lived experience makes a big difference. Perfect example, I was a little late to this particular interview because I was at a house of a grieving mother who recently lost her husband, who has two sons that are in the streets. And one just caught a case, and I was at the house trying to create some type of family arrangement, because it's to the point where, you know, the son is disrespecting the mother, and the mother is almost putting herself to the level of the son by going back and forth with him. Mm. So, I mean, it's a situation where domestically, inside the schools, it's important for us men and women who are adults who really care to play a role. It's not just about telling the school what books they have inside or telling the teacher what to teach. It's about being able to cultivate a belongingness, yes, inside schools. It's about to create a belongingness inside the home. You know, we know that kids are affected through their houses, through the streets, and through school. Those are the three areas and the points of contact which we must invest our time. I'm presently finishing up a gang prevention course, and they speak very succinctly and elaborately on how kids aren't running two gangs. They're running away from other situations. And it's the same thing like you were just saying, Kimberly. That particular young lady wasn't running to violence. She's running away from a situation. And yes, that's where we have to find our focus. We are so caught up in the what, the behavior, that we don't often investigate the why, which is where we can now help them understand what's going on, help them to self-regulate, help them become engines of their own change. So if I want to snug and at my own company, clean up the block, that's what we do.
I like when you mentioned that you go into the homes and support the adults, because I think sometimes, well, not sometimes, right? The adults are often the problem. And how do you give guidance to an adult?
In my mind, they're always the problem. And here's why I'll say that. The minute you forecast the future of a child, you, in a negative way, you remove them of having a choice. And when you remove the choice, you remove the chance. So I'm of the belief and the understanding there's no such thing as a broken child, only broken systems.
Definitely broken systems.
That have neglected and abandoned this child. In many cases, most of the kids we're dealing with that are quote unquote the biggest problems, which I don't believe any kid is a problem or bad, I just think they're busy, are the same ones who deal with the most severe trauma. It's funny to me that people that deal with the most severe trauma are the ones that we are the quickest to condemn.
Mm. Well, it's just like, you know, the people who have the least, we blame them for having little, right? It's like if you're born with nothing. I'm like in a just society, when you're born with something. And then only over time does it diminish if you don't, you know, work towards increasing it. But we allow people in our society to be born with nothing. And then say, hey, you got to go get it. Well, how do you? We all know it's hard to get something when you have nothing, right? Most people get something or get more when they already have something, you know, to negotiate. That's why credit is king, because credit allows you to have something initially, right? But I digress. We want to go. Okay.
Right.
Huh?
I said, I totally agree. It's a lack of knowledge on many fronts. And it's also emotionally, a lot of us are disturbed because of the events. The world is moving fast. The world is moving fast, and a lot of us have had the grasp to really wrap our brains around. I mean, parents got to recognize that 95% of children have a smartphone. You know what I mean? African Americans got to recognize that, unfortunately, they're 17 times more likely to die by gun violence. So these are not just numbers. These are parameters for us to recognize where the problems exist, for us to begin to address them. Not all at one time, but individually, and not with one person doing it, but collectively.
And you say collectively, and I want to know, does SNUG operate within, or I should say operate interacting with other systems? The educational system, the social welfare system, the financial systems. I think financial institutions could play a big role. I think when people learn something that they can aspire to or towards, then that helps, right? That helps a community. We have schools that are supported by certain businesses and to say if you have a student, they can come to this school free of charge because they're recognizing that they want to give back in some way. But is there some other meaningful way that these interactions could exist as opposed to just being donating money or donating computers? You know, what other ways might these systems be interacting? I want this show to be one in which we are talking about things, but also can give someone who's listening a modicum of knowledge so that they can go, okay, tomorrow I can do this.
Well, it's all about bridge building. A lot of resources are available and a lot of people need resources. But the linkage between the two is sometimes not apparent. And so anybody that has the knowledge and the resources or has the knowledge in general should extend themselves. You got to get past the point where you're looking for a savior and it's not going to come.
Certainly our government.
It's just not going to come. See, the reason why the government is either lauded or demeaned is because of the role that they play depending upon the moment in time. I mean, you got so many people that's against the government because they open the doors for marginalized communities. Then you got people that are against the government because they feel like all they do is take care of the rich. So my thing is, I'm not going to get caught in that semantic conversation. I'm not going to waste my time trying to control things that I have no true control over. I vote. I'm not saying anything about that. But I mean, I'm not going to tie my hands waiting for a savior. I think it's very important that we recognize that being bridge builders, there are opportunities for greatness every day. Just social capital. Opening the door for somebody. How you doing? Good morning. Good night. How was your day? These are the things that begin to make community, community. There's no community without unity. And the minute we can't have a casual conversation or we can't extend a positive gesture to one another, what else can really be done? If those small incremental moments can't be captured, then what can really be done? So my thing is to start small. I look at this very scientifically, very surgically, very realistically. We start small, incrementally. We start with our young people. 11 to 15 is the average age of gang recruitment. But at the same time, if you're 11 years old, where do you get a job? If you're 11 years old and you start selling drugs, that's a job. If you're 11 years old, where can you get a job? Where, even if you did get a job, where would you have any upward mobility? If you're 11 years old, you start selling drugs, it's upward mobility there. So my thing is to turn the paradigms on their head. I have to be as ferocious, as concentrated, and as powerfully positioned as the enemies of the progress of those that I serve.
So what I'm hearing is you have to meet a child where they are, in their space, in their community. And so you need to have a bridge for almost every industry and or system. So we don't have one-stop shopping for our children. So if a person is athletically inclined, then you have support system for their interest in that way. And then you bring in these other items like learning about financial stability and how to take care of yourself. And for those who are more traumatized, what is good mental health access look like for young people, right? And I think also to take away the stigma of being poor, or like my mother would say, we're not poor, we're broke. We don't have any money. but that doesn't make us any less than anybody else, you know. And so I think they all are issues that our young people are dealing with when they go to school, and they're seeing this hobnob of community of all students from every walk of life, every ability with their studies, every look at family life and structure, you know. So, and most people always think the life that they're looking at is better than theirs, but they don't know the deep reality that everyone suffers something. And to have some people around you to have that space where you can have acceptance is what is going to cure the ailment in some fashion or form. But you need the institutions, you need the systems to support the growth of each young person. I think that I got what I wanted out of the show, but I want to open it up right now to...
Can I just add one quick thing to the point you made? I work to reduce gun violence in the city, and I find gun violence affects all systems, the health system, the school system, the prison system, the family system. It affects every system. But it's very important that we separate poverty from pauperism. See, pauperism is a concept, a social concept that was created to demonize, vilify, and put a behavioral context to not having the income that one would say is what you should have in a given society. So pauperism is that demonization and that vilification. But poverty is just poverty. A lot of people that are financially in good shape are morally bankrupt. So poverty is poverty.
Well, that would make me think of Good Times. Right? They may have lived in the projects, but, you know, they had all that they needed to be surrounded by love and care and camaraderie. I mean, right?
Yes. Many immigrant communities are the best example. They've done studies and found that, especially Asian communities, they can be poor, but the crime level is lower than some areas that are affluent. Because it's not just the money. Poverty is not a driver, particularly of crime in general. It's the social systems that surround poverty. Yes. It's the social systems that create poverty. It's the social systems that allow poverty to persist, to flourish, that create people, that create situations where people go out and do things that are irreversibly damaging.
And I think that's right. I wanted to ask Ray something, and then we're going to allow Collins, because Ray, you mentioned your...
Thank you for the time.
Oh, you're gonna stay on, right? You're staying on, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Ray, you mentioned you came from a really rough community, a rough space. Let me ask you, were there more criminals in your space or less criminals in your space? And I guess what I'm saying is, the majority of people in your rough neighborhood, how many of them were what you would consider a criminal or a person that was going towards crime? The majority or the minority group?
It was really a lot of criminals where I grew up at, but the one thing I would say about people from the hood, whatever you want to call it, those criminals, they actually kept it away pretty well to an extent, especially like if you were a kid coming up that had like a bright future, they really kept you away from a lot of things that they were doing. But then you did have some of the guys that, you know, I guess when a kid didn't seem like he was headed anywhere, that they would, you know, bring him in. But they did a good job of hiding it. But there were a lot of criminals where I grew up from.
Because I guess when I mentioned the word criminal, I was thinking that in many cases, it's not a lot of crime. I mean, there's not a lot of criminals in any neighborhood, negative neighborhood that you said you were growing up. The majority of people in that place are not criminals. They're doing what they do every day to survive, but they're not stealing or, you know, cheating or thieving or anything like that. They're just making their way. And then those are, like in what you would say, some people which were gang members. So a small group of people who then, you know, took the place of maybe what family was supposed to be or what fatherhood or motherhood might have looked like. What would you say to that?
Well, I think the way it is now compared to when I grew up is it was a little more organized. So Growing up, we lived by it takes a village to raise a family, and I don't think that I think we've lost tune with what that means. Now the crime rate where I'm from is skyrocketed. It's people stealing stuff left and right. It's like the purge, you know, now where I'm originally from. But before, like I said, it was a lot more structured. It was more people were more in tune with family. You know, everybody got together on Sunday. Nobody's doing that anymore. So I think that you know, go back to what Eric was saying, the bridge, I think that we lost what it means to when we grew up believing it takes a village. We just don't have that anymore.
Now, Eric, you mentioned what you were saying. Is there some response you would like to make? And I'm asking you this because we've been told that we had a call-in, but we're not exactly sure that the call-in is going to work. So as we are trying to seek to make that happen, I'd like for us to start our round table now where our guests, both Ray and Eric and John, can talk to one another and open up more about what they had started in their own particular segments. So, Eric, I'll open it up to you and ask, is there any response you wanted to add or something more you wanted to say as to maybe my question or something that Ray has just brought up?
Certainly. It's like if you have five dishes in front of you to eat and four of them are kind of comparable, but one of them is just like, you know, put together with ingredients that nobody's going to like. That's always going to be more remembered. So we got to understand the psychological impact of what media can do in terms of promulgating this concept of this criminal, the world's on fire. I've been hearing that part, like the world's on fire. We got to be careful how those concepts can invade our minds and then have us painting others as well as ourselves with a broad brush. And that's what happens often. A lot of our young people paint themselves with a broad brush. They paint themselves as future criminals. I mean, we started early with the concepts of cops and robbers, as if it's just some staunch dichotomy. I mean, it's a phrase like shooters that drives me crazy, because a person that has shot a gun doesn't make them a shooter. We often create these labels, and we put people in these boxes, and then we wonder which is number the caste system. And then we wonder why they behave in the way that they behave. Once you feel like society has given up on you, it's not hard for you sometimes to give up on yourself. So what I would say is, whenever we see high crime, we're dealing with high trauma. Whenever we see high violence, we're dealing with high trauma. We got to approach it through a healthcare perspective. We got to approach it as if this is a person in a burning... If a child was in a burning building, nobody would sit back talking about they need to get themselves together. They need to figure it out. Exactly. They need to know right from wrong. Nobody would say that if a child was in the burning building. They would go into that building with all of the tools that they had at their disposal, and they would save that child. And so conceptually, that's how I see it.
Can I chime in on that one?
Absolutely.
Sure, brother.
So with what you're saying, I agree with you, but also I don't really think that it's the community that's putting it out there. And what I mean by when I say that is, for instance, I'm currently located in Arizona. So to go back to what you were saying about the school systems, and you were saying that it starts with the teachers. Yes, it starts with the teachers, but also at the end of the day, it starts with, and I really hate to get into politics, but it starts with the government, right? Because there's programs out here where I'm at now, and there's grants that the government will deny a school to have just so they can open up a prison. Now, my son, my son just committed to the University of Oregon, if you can't see that.
Congratulations, Dad.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank
you. He has an O and Dad underneath the O, so you must just pick that up.
Yes, it's the University of Oregon. But when my son was 15, me working with the schools through my nonprofit, and my ultimate goal is to create an after-school program. And so for me, an after-school program really changed my life. Because you can only attend this after-school program if you were doing everything that you need to do. Now, I was trying to create after-school programs through the school systems out here in Arizona. Arizona has one of the worst education systems in America. It was like 47. They were ranked 47 when I was...
When I was doing
all the after-school program stuff. I asked my son a specific question. I knew the answer, but I wanted to see if my son knew the answer. I said, what age could you legally drop out of school in Arizona? And he knew that answer. Why would my son know this answer? So this is something that they're teaching them in the schools. This is something that this is information that they've made available. And you with the kid having this knowledge, you're already setting him up for success, because in his mind, he's going to think, well, I don't need to be here. I can legally drop out without getting in trouble. And so it's the same way with what I was saying back to the crime rate in California, where I'm from, the Bay Area. They said that anything under $800 is not considered a crime. So now you just got people stealing left and right, because they know if they steal less than $800, they're not going to get in trouble. So when you have information like this available to people, and like you said, trauma, or you might have, it might not even be trauma. It might be desperation, because you have a lot of people that are desperate to survive. Not everybody has food on their table. So of course they're going to go steal that $800 worth, because they know they're not going to get in trouble. So like I said, when you have this type of information available, it sets up for failure. We're set up for failure, and we buy into this.
Great point, my brother. There's a lot of social eugenics definitely taking place. What I find is the parents blame the teachers, and the teachers blame the parents. And then we all blame the government.
Or the children.
Right? Now, let's go. When you think about Arizona, let's talk about the history of Arizona. In 1914, Arizona was one of the first states that tried to concoct the concept of a peaceful killing, peaceful execution, right, through a chemical concoction. Arizona's eugenics and the policies were so overtly destructive in terms of a human condition that Adolf Hitler took some of his notes in Mein Kampf from Arizona. So I'm at this point, brother. I'm not looking for the government to do anything more than they've done. I'm looking for us to stand up for each other. And if that means us now pressuring a government body to do something, I'm all for that. But I'm not sitting back waiting for them to do one thing one more day. It's all about what we can do for each other. We got to stand up. We got to get together. We got to show more love and have more compassion and recognize it is not a government agency that can help us through this problem more than we can help ourselves.
And I'm going to add something to build the bridge between your two conversations. I work for the government, and I see firsthand how government helps those who what? Helps themselves. Government is about people, for the people. We elect them or not, but it's up to us. And we need to ask or hold people accountable. So the government is there to help as a group those of us singly and individually who needs help. But very few of us vote to say, I want this person in the office to be there to help me. We seldom vote our needs. We vote what people look like, or, you know, what they said yesterday, or how they smell. I don't know. But we seldom vote, does this person know enough to be able to give me the attention I deserve and my community the attention they deserve? And do we communicate enough together as a community to make sure we put somebody in place that can represent us? So I want to say yes to both of you, that it can be a morally corrupt government if we as individual people who come together to vote on, you know, who's going to be elected and selected to represent us, if we don't do our job in that way. So I want to thank you all. I mean, I can talk half an hour or more, but we're running.
We'll end up like Russia.
But we're running out of time.
Bring it full circle.
But we're running out of time. I want to thank my guests, Ray Warren and Eric Thompson. You both are always welcome to be on my show. And I want to lend myself to John to say to him, it's not just the wealthy that are treated badly, because Anastasia was wealthy. Her family was the creme de la creme, and even the creme de la creme can be murdered.
Absolutely. Good point.
So thank you all, and come back next month. the third Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8, where we have the very necessary conversation on race and ethnicity and multiple identities.